For many people this day, the water jars are empty. The wine has given out. They are indeed forsaken and desolate. Hope has fled. Chaos and destruction rule. Food, water, medical attention, protection from the elements, family cohesion, they're all lacking. Schools, hospitals, churches, homes, government offices, they're gone, collapsed, broken. Shock and grief, anger, fear rule. Some are adding to the unbearable weight of the victims through ignorant and bigoted statements purporting to be of a spiritual nature. May their words be shown for what they are, hellish in nature and rejected. As the psalmist says, the words of their mouths are mischief and deceit. They have ceased to act wisely and do good. They plot mischief while on their beds. They are set on a way that is not good. They do not reject evil. Where is the new wine? Where is delight and joy, surprise, and the miracle of human kindness healing the wounded? Where is the presence of God? Where it always is when tragedy strikes. In the hymns which are sung in the darkness, in the prayers of the sorrowing, in the heart of the world's people who are quickly responding with supplies and money and the hands and tools of rescuers, who are coming to relieve the suffering of many, because that is what humanity does at its best. And we all know that some terrible tragedy could happen to us, wherever we are, whoever we are, no matter how rich and technologically advanced and spiritual we may be, and we will need the neighbor to come to us in our time of need. We know that wholeness is our true home, and we bring what we can to make that possible for others when they are broken and distraught, their lives turn into rubble. We go in the way of the Holy One when we bring the cup of water, the kind word, the skilled intervention, the money that belongs to God in the first place, the labor that slowly brings order back into a chaotic world. Love and truth join hands in the cause of Tikkun Olam, a Hebrew phrase that means repairing the world. So today I am moved to dedicate this sermon to the people of Haiti, and I pray that it may be just a little bit worthy of their struggle. Please pray with me. Living God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, for you are our rock and redeemer, who guides us along the way, this day and every day. Amen. I want to speak in the spirit of the prophet Isaiah, and so I will not remain silent. I will speak. I will speak the Lord's word of hope to you, to me, and to God. I will speak until I see the renewal of truth and love in me, in you, in this church, in the larger community, in the world. For if I wish to be useful to God and to neighbor, I will speak until evil is replaced by good, until untruth is replaced by truth, until brokenness and disarray is replaced by wholeness and order and ardor, and until the new shoots of green poke up through the brown earth and give life. And I will tell you again and again who you and I and our neighbor and our community really are, vessels of hope and faith and love, beloved by God, whose use is that of living authentically in this world. This is what it means to live in the spirit of the ancient prophet Isaiah, who brought the word of the Lord to the Jewish exiles in Babylon as they yearned to return home. He spoke to give them hope, to light a fire under their prayers, to encourage their faith. All they had were the memories of times long gone, and the reality of their situation far away from home, where they made the best of it and began to redevelop their tradition, with synagogue and worship and always the retelling of the stories, the roots of their tradition. I think that this may be one of the most important ways to live in our world today, in which there is so much suffering and injustice, corruption and sadness, anger and fear. People are looking for their soul's home, for a firm place on which to stand that makes sense, that gives meaning, that provides a foundation that will not give way under the stress of economic uncertainty, the assaults of the purveyors of intolerance and selfishness, or the intrusion of violence in all its guises. Looking back often degenerates into nostalgia rather than renewed energy and vision for today. The traditional ways of believing and seeing, acting and speaking no longer seem to work very well. We need genuine community across the old divisions of race, class, national origin and citizenship, and religious tradition. We need connections and understandings that slip powerfully into action, like gears in a huge machine, when the earth itself shakes and destroys people's lives. We need prophets. We need integrity. We need servant-hearted people in places of power and influence. We need courage. We need repentant and regenerating souls. And in Babylon, the years passed by, the decades passed by, and the people remembered and wrote and pondered and waited and made the best of it. They lived and married and had families, engaged in work and play, and passed on. And then one day, about the year 539 before the Common Era, Cyrus, the new king of Persia, proclaimed an end to their exile and allowed them to return home to their native land, giving them the sacred vessels and other objects from the plundered temple in Jerusalem to take back with them, and even encouraging them to rebuild the temple with funds from the royal treasury of Persia itself. Many of them made the long trip westward with high hopes and expectations. And when they arrived, they found a sight that must have been very discouraging. The land seemed to them as a desert. It was not empty. Many people had stayed in Judah and the land and during the years of exile. Others had moved into the area, making a life for themselves in Jerusalem and the surrounding countryside. But none were able to undo the damage done by Nebuchadnezzar and his army decades before. It was all the exiles could do to secure homesteads for themselves, to try to grow crops, to feed themselves. Times were difficult, people were hungry. And when they were finally moved to start rebuilding the temple, it was clear that its glory could not match the glory of former days. Where were the glittering jewels? Where was the abundant feast? The land still felt like a desert. The city seemed forsaken, bereft of God's sustaining presence. So of what use were those promises that we heard from the book of Isaiah? You shall be called by a new name. You shall be a crown of beauty. You shall be called, my delight is in her, and your land married. So shall your God rejoice over you. The key is that the prophet knows that God has spoken. The key is that the prophet faces into present reality and sees it for what it is. And so the prophet vows to hold God to God's promises. The prophet will pick up right where God seems to have left off and make sure that God gets no rest. A very Jewish thing to do. That God gets no rest until the holy city is built up, filled with her children, surrounded by fruitful fields, shining with the continuous light of God's presence. And the prophet will speak again to the people who are co-creators with God of God's desire for them, And he will encourage them to place one foot in front of the other so that their experimental, incremental steps toward becoming a renewed people begin to take effect, gradually changing their self-awareness, remaking them from the inside out and from the outside in. Those internal places of hope and faith and love need exercise to become proficient and practiced. Moment-to-moment choices in speech, in action, in self-imaging can move them toward the heavenly city and away from all that is broken and disorderly and hellish. It will be a lot of work, but it will be good work, and it will result in new life. And the prophet does a very important thing. He or she tells them that the former glories are gone and that they seek fool's gold if they try to recapture them. In reality, the former days were never as shining and glorious as memory makes them. And the historical context is irrevocably shifted, never again to return. God is in the present, not the past. God's very name, YHWH, Yod-Heh, Vav-Heh in Hebrew, is a verbal form, not a noun, Yahweh. And as surely as the cosmos itself continually changes, so does the life of a person, a family, a community of faith, a nation. Yesterday, I went on the World Wide Web, and using Google Maps, I viewed the home where my grandmother and grandfather used to live. Last saw it in 1995. My grandmother died in 86, and the house was sold. I remember as it used to be. I got on the web and clicked until it showed me a street-level view. It is nothing as it was. The trees are gone. The grass is brown. It looks disheveled. It hit me very deep. And that's what it is. It can never return to the way I remember it. It belongs to someone else. And I need to hold those favorite memories and then bless God for them and thank God for them and then let go, because they are no longer. I need those memories to give me energy for what lies ahead of me. I need to remember what my grandmother used to tell me, how she used to greet me, us, as we visited her. Not hold on to the sorrow and depression that can come when we see something that has changed and we cannot have it back. I was watching an alpine ski race the other day on Universal Sports. And the commentator was, we were watching a woman ski down the slope. And the commentator said, "She is a shadow of the woman she was a few years ago." And what he meant to say is that her, as a skier, she is a shadow of the skier she used to be. No doubt she has changed inside, and that affects how she skis now. She reached the pinnacle. She was a world champion, and she is no longer. And she is striving to reach the top again. But can she do it? Can she use the same motivations, the same reasons? She's older. She's more experienced. But can she do it exactly the same way? Life has gone on. Life has shifted. There are newer, younger, stronger, more agile women skiing that same slope. She may find a way, but it must be toward a state of mind and body and skill that fits her now. Just as marriages and friendships, alliances, careers, viewpoints, weather patterns, our own bodies change over time and require new eyes to see and ears to hear. So we must find renewed ways of being of use in our families, to our enemies, in our friendships or workplaces, our faith communities, and in the world. A prophet is less one who can foretell the future, and more, in the biblical sense, one who forth tells God's presence in the present. It's not about guessing what's going to happen out there. It's what God is doing here and now, and forthtelling that. Each of us can become, must become, in our own way, a prophet. Speaking and acting in ways that communicates the ways of the Lord to each other, so that we encourage one another, so that we show one another the very nature of the holy city that is coming, even in its shadowy form to this earth. Last week, some of us worked with Rich Toffel on to elicit the core values of this congregation. And we met afterwards, met for 2 hours. A very skilled person. He drew us through this process of coming up with clusters of verbs that I think in the end run captured the authentic nature of this congregation. There are four groups. Each group chose a different set of verbs. We were different. And we were united. Both go together. He reminded us that there are 12 gates to the city. In the book of Revelation, God accepts all the differences and draws us toward a common home. And we decided the following words best summed up this church's greatest use: grow, illuminate, enlighten, renew, or regenerate. And we decided that the way we treat one another, plus how we connect to the larger community, is of great importance. So listen to the good news. We are guests at a wedding banquet, to use the image in the Gospel of John for today. We are at a communal celebration of joy. Somebody else put on the feast. Somebody else is getting married. We're guests. And behind the scenes, the wine runs out. And the huge water vessels are found empty because they're not meant to be used for a wedding. They're used for purification rites. So how can the guests continue their celebration? I think what we're finding out in this community of faith is that the Lord is responding to our need. Surprise, the Lord is beginning to bring out the best wine now. People freely choosing unity through a common commitment to one another and the greater good and a balance of love and truth. It is the Lord who has brought us to this place, and the Lord will see us through. We are being changed, transformed just a little bit at a time, into a sacramental, life-giving presence for one another and for the larger community. Therefore, we have hope, not in our own cleverness, not in our own hard work, not in some inherent goodness, not because we deserve something good. The people of Haiti deserve something good. They've never had anything good. And they too are God's children. It's not about deserving. We here can have hope because ordinary water, the people of this faith community, are being changed into very good wine. As we continue to live in God and allow God to live in us and between us, we are invited to become co-creators of the future, not passive victims, not infants depending on our mother's milk, not mere observers of a performance put on by someone else. We are invited to be of use to one another and to the larger community, to bring forth a hint of the heavenly city into the reality of this world. I read something the other day by a preacher who said she's really challenged by the command of one of her teachers to put a sermon into 5 words. So I came up with five words, but I don't know if they really fit now, but they did when I wrote this. Maybe you have your own five words about what this whole thing means to you. If you were to preach this sermon, how would you say it in five words? I would put it, perhaps, live now into God's future. You come up with your own five. Tell me later. May it be so. Amen.